Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Good morning, and I am Paul Horn, filling in for Jim Popova for this week's Lifetime Income. When assisting clients here at Financial Sense Wealth Management, we help our clients grow, manage, and protect their assets. Over 90% of the time, advisors focus just on the growth and management piece. In reality, it can be more difficult to protect and maintain the wealth over the long term, and this one makes the protection piece so important to an individual's overall financial plan. Today on the show, we are lucky to have with us Elizabeth Morgan, who's a leading authority in asset protection strategies. Elizabeth, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself, how you've become a recognized leader in asset protection?
Good morning, Paul. I'm really happy to be on the show today. In terms of how I got to where I am, that's actually a really long story that needs a big cup of coffee, probably. But I think that my background is as an estate planning attorney. I started my life working for a big firm, Jenkins and Gilchrist, in Dallas, Texas. But my family's background is in banking and investment advisory services. And in the 70s, we were a remittance basis jurisdiction. So my father managed portfolios in foreign trusts and as a tax shelter when it was legal. And then in 75, when the rules changed, then the question was asset protection still an important diversification tool from an investment standpoint? And he believed that it was. So with that in mind, and the banking and investment services background, I went to law school and started doing estate planning, and was surprised at the fact that most estate planning lawyers didn't understand the importance of asset protection as part of the wealth management process. So eventually I left the big firm because the big firm wasn't comfortable with the concept of asset protection necessarily, and joined with other like-minded lawyers and started a new firm in 1994, and have been practicing in that small firm environment ever since, doing primarily asset protection, wealth diversification kinds of strategies.
Is asset protection technically legal in the U.S.?
Yes, that's a really great question. If you were to ask a plaintiff's lawyer, they will convince themselves that asset protection, there's something wrong with it, and it's only because you're protecting the assets from them. Asset protection is actually really one of the foundational concepts of a free economy. So when our country, which was really a great experiment, was formed, one of the things that our founding fathers realized was that the kind of dying European environment they had come from had a couple of things in common. And one of them was that there was no real process for somebody who's made a mistake to work through that issue in terms of getting rid of creditors so that they could start again. They had receivership processes, but there was no way for the debt to actually be forgiven. So our country was developed around this concept that an individual should be encouraged to take risk. And if that risk was a reasonable risk and the individual ended up in a situation where it was impossible to work through and pay off all of the existing creditors, that there should be a process to allow that. And that became both our bankruptcy system, which is a federal system, and the state law of exemptions, which embody the types of assets that will become exempt from creditors. So we have actually Supreme Court cases that validate asset protection as being constitutional. So the answer is no, it is not against the law in the United States. And in fact, it forms the foundational structure for a free economic system.
All right. And I want to touch on something a little bit further that you'd mentioned there, state exemptions. When you're talking about that, I assume you're referring to things like homestead provision. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Sure. So every state has a body of law that exempts certain assets from the claims of creditors, you know, the kinds of things that you would assume possibly to be exempt. So you've got homestead. Every state has a different homestead exemption. Some of them will exempt either acreage. So Florida and Texas are the really well-known ones, but there are some other states that do it as well. So as long as your building your home is on the acreage that's defined by statute, it doesn't matter what the value is, creditors can't reach that asset. Other states like Massachusetts and California and New York will only exempt certain cash amounts in that homestead. But that's a good example of an exemption. Other examples are cash value of life insurance, 529 plans, annuities. You have certain trusts called spendthrift trusts that are protected from the claims of creditors. And then you have asset protected types of entities, which would be like your limited liability partnerships, limited liability companies, et cetera. So each state has a body of law dealing with those exemptions. There's also a federal body of law dealing with those exemptions in bankruptcy. So if you move out of court at the state level where your state exemptions will be applied into a federal bankruptcy, which is a federal body of law, there is a separate set of exemptions. But both at the state and the federal level, you have exemptions, you know, kind of like nice, neat little buckets that you could fill with assets to protect them from the claims of future creditors.
So with the complexity here of each state having their own rules, and then you have federal rules as well that you need to balance, how important is it when someone is putting together their protection plan for their assets to work with an attorney that understands their state's rules?
It's very, very important to understand your state's rules. And it's also very, very important to understand that other states for entities have different rules. Because while you as a domiciliary of a certain state are subject to that state's rules with regard to exempt assets, it's possible to create a new entity separate from yourself that would be subject to the rules of a different jurisdiction. So it's in this area, it's important to understand all 50 states in terms of exemptions in order to craft the appropriate asset protection plan. And you have to really understand, too, what law is going to apply. So what law will apply to you as an individual, and then what law will apply to the entity as an entity.
Makes sense. I know here we're looking at it here in San Diego, and so we have a lot of clients here in California. It's not too uncommon for me to see with some of our higher net worth clients, them have trusts in other states like Nevada, Delaware, Alaska. Do these rules at the state level create opportunities for additional protection strategies?
So that is really a very, very, very important question. So if you can bear with me to give a little legal analysis, and I apologize because a lot of this is very technical, but in answering your question, you have to determine who would be subject to the particular action and what law would apply. So let's just talk about this a little bit. When we're thinking about this, we have to first understand that a court can obtain jurisdiction over a person, a trust, an entity in different ways. There are two primary ways. First is called in personam jurisdiction, which means they can get jurisdiction over a person where they are located. So they can either be located there temporarily, you know, if you can serve them, or they can be domiciled there. In other words, where their homestead is, where they permanently live. So that's in personam jurisdiction. There's also in rem jurisdiction, which means you can get jurisdiction over somebody if you can get to the property that that individual owns. So that's in rem and in personam jurisdiction. Now, when you're thinking about a trust is a relationship among individuals. You've got a settlor, a trustee, and a beneficiary. So courts can obtain jurisdiction over that trust if they can get jurisdiction over anyone who controls the trust. So that would be the trustee or the protector, any place where the trust owns property, or if the beneficiary has a right to demand something from the trust, any place where the beneficiary resides, owns property, or is domiciled. So a trust is very different. It looks more like an individual than an entity, and entities have their own independent life. So they live in two places. They live where they are organized, and they live where they are administered. However, the law that will apply to that entity can be chosen. So even if you're being administered in California, but you've chosen Delaware, Delaware law should apply. So an entity is very different from a trust or an individual. So what that means is if you are a California domiciliary and you organize a Delaware or a Nevada entity, even though a California court would have jurisdiction over that entity because it's administered in California, it would nonetheless be required to apply the law of Delaware because it is a separate entity with its own choice of law. Now, contrast that with a trust. A trust is like an individual. It's a relationship. So that trust, even though it's chosen to apply the law of Delaware, unfortunately, the court is not going to apply that law. It's going to apply the law of its own jurisdiction. So if it has, if that trust has property in California, even though it's a Delaware trust, the court will apply Delaware law. And that's because of all of the case law we have about trust that require the court to apply the law of either the location of a trustee or the property that the trust owns. Now, you could have a closer connection argument. You might be able to argue that venue isn't proper, that there's a closer connection in a different jurisdiction. But from the case law that we've been getting, the courts would apply Delaware law to this type of structure only if the trustee, the protector, and the property were all located in Delaware.
So often trusts are thought of as estate planning tools. And I know with the changes here with the tax law this past year, I begin to see some of my own clients begin to question whether they need a trust or not. How can trust be a valuable planning tool for asset protection?
So that's a great question. I mean, a lot of people were thinking, gosh, estate tax exemption's gone up to crazy levels. Why do we need to use trust? There are a whole lot of reasons why trusts are great. Trusts will remain important as a protection vehicle in divorce. Unfortunately, our divorce rate in this country is past the 60% mark for first-time marriages. So even though we don't need those trusts for true tax planning, it still remains incredibly important for divorce planning and for asset protection. So even if the spouse isn't the creditor, parents setting up trusts for their children who are going into really risky types of environments like being a doctor or a lawyer or an investment professional or, gosh, someone who manufactures health foods, somebody who's competing with the FDA or some other business venture can establish a trust to make sure that those particular assets are protected from the claims of creditors. There are still, and there's a growing body of jurisdictions in our country that are developing asset protection laws that would allow residents and domiciliaries of those particular states to establish asset protection trusts. So as long as they're dealing with future creditors, not existing creditors necessarily, those assets would be protected from the claims of creditors. There just continues to be a very active plaintiff's bar in our country. And that plaintiff's bar is motivated by making money, by suing people who have money. So one of the trusts remain the battleground, kind of the hill on which we decide to stake our claim. So even though we don't need those trusts necessarily for tax planning, it remains a wonderful way to protect those assets from children and successive generations from creditors and sometimes from our own stupidity or negligence or...
Mistakes happen.
Yeah, mistakes happen. Exactly.
Understand. So it sounds like a good type of insurance policy or something you hopefully don't have to use, but God forbid something happens, you have it there to help protect yourself. You had mentioned the plaintiff bar there. Can you elaborate a little bit more on how the U.S. legal system kind of creates the need for this asset protection?
You know, our country, maybe I harp on this too much, but we were the most amazing kind of social experiment ever, really. I wish we would spend more time in school studying this, but our legal system is completely different from any of the other Western legal systems. I mean, we just kind of assume that we function like Germany or Australia or England or whatever. I just got an email this morning from a lawyer in Australia completely not understanding something in our system. So it's kind of like, you know, the common law. Yes, we are based on common law, but completely different. So our system was developed, again, to allow free flow of funds and the ability of really all citizens to avail themselves of the benefits of really everything in government and in the economy. So for instance, we allow contingent fees, which means that individuals can hire a lawyer and the lawyer doesn't take a retainer or doesn't get paid until the case is settled or there's a judgment in favor of the client. That is absolutely not allowed in any of the other Western jurisdictions. In the 18th century, when we devised our system, we wanted to give people free access to the court system. So that was a wonderful way to do it. The flip side of it is it's created a situation where lawyers can partner with potential plaintiffs to get a return on their, you know, on their efforts and their money. And so the greater the return, the better. So what it does is incentivizes litigation. The other couple of things that incentivize litigation in the United States that were put in place for a good reason, but have encouraged this, is we don't have a loser pay system like the other jurisdictions do. Again, we wanted to encourage litigation, not discourage it. And now it's a bit out of control. We also have no bond requirements unless you're filing an appeal after the original judgment. Those other jurisdictions have a bond that's required, usually a percentage of the recovery that you're asking for. Another thing that our system allows for is for us to ask for punitive damages against civil defendants. And that's typically in other jurisdictions not allowed unless you had as a defendant a corporate client. The reason being that punitive damages, the idea is if you've done something that should, you know, you did it intentionally, so therefore you should be penalized, that our criminal statute should be applied to send you to jail. But again, our system has expanded to allow for those big punitive damages against individuals in civil cases, which makes the plaintiff's bar really happy because that means their judgments get much bigger. But it also means that we have to be very proactive about protecting clients' assets before a lawsuit's filed, to protect them against that punitive calculation.
I really liked one thing you said there is must be proactive. And I think this is an important point for people to understand. When you're doing this type of planning, you can't do it after the fact. This has to be done before an incident occurs and that lawsuit pops up. The common example I've seen with a lot of clients here personally has been rental real estate. Someone slips and falls on a rental property, their properties are held in their name, all their assets are essentially up for grabs by the plaintiffs. Having this, some sort of protection with a trust or another protection vehicle can be one of many ways to help shield themselves from that sort of litigation.
That's right. That's right. And that's the kind of thing that needs to be done way in advance. The unfortunate thing is that the majority of us would rather go, nah, 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 it won't happen to me. And I completely understand that. Going to see your asset protection lawyer, you know, it's bad enough going to your estate planning lawyer and talking about dying, but going and talking, sitting with your asset protection lawyer, thinking through all of the kind of parade of horribles that will happen to you is a miserable experience. But if you just think about doing it in little tiny bits, right, you can't eat an elephant all at once, just, you know, putting little things in place, looking at your insurance, making sure that it actually covers the things that you think that it covers, spending the time with a good financial professional who can help you think through, gosh, could I start putting money in a 529 plan. Think about that as a protection vehicle. It's kind of a crazy thing to do, but if you do it and the kids don't need it, you can take it out later and just pay your 10% penalty in your income tax. That's really not a bad asset protection vehicle. That's a little box with almost no cost. And just slowly but surely, start building your castle by one brick at a time. Just shoring it up, shoring it up, shoring it up, and staying focused on it So when the problems occur, you have a whole bunch of little buckets filled with asset protection. And it may be that one bucket will fail, but hopefully not all of them would fail at once.
Yeah, and it's interesting because most people don't realize if they already have some of those bricks in place, whether it be their 401k with their employer, the 401ks provide some asset protection benefits there that you will not find in an IRA. A lot of clients do have 529s, do have insurance policies. As you had mentioned before, as long as the registration is set up correctly on those policies, they can add some additional layers of benefit as well.
That's right.
Now, earlier you had mentioned the tax law changes and how it's kind of not made trust as necessary right now for estate planning wise. Has the tax law changes had any impact on planning strategies for asset preservation?
There is a lot going around right now. I'm sure everyone is watching all of these crazy ideas that people are starting to promulgate. So there are these ideas that people are using mostly to, I think, market products. So first, I would say to your listeners, be very careful because there are a lot of product-based, even accounting firms that are hawking ideas. But some of them that I've seen that are interesting is, especially for those of you who live in states like California or New York, where you're limited now to $10,000 of income tax, property tax, sales tax, which makes it incredibly hard for you to get the benefit of that deduction. Some people are suggesting that you move assets into an asset protected trust in Delaware or Alaska or Nevada, and then you make that a completed gift trust instead of an incomplete gift trust. So it's not a grantor trust, so the income's not flowing through to you. Make that trust its own taxpayer. And then as its own taxpayer, it will get the benefit of the property tax. Let's say that you have five pieces of real estate and they're not rental. So you're not getting the benefit of some kind of business deduction. You would use these trusts, five different ones of them, to get $10,000 of the property tax exempt against the income. Now, you have to have some income to get the benefit of that deduction. Where's that coming from? And secondarily, the problem with that structure, I think, is that you get to the maximum marginal tax rate. Granted, it's now down to 37%, but you hit that at $12,000 of income. But I think that what these people are doing is they're making sure that that income stays below the maximum rate, and they're getting the offset of the $10,000 deduction. And you can see how that might be a possibility if done properly. So I'm starting to see that, and on the trust side, I think that it will be interesting to watch how this happens, because my concern is that while the corporate changes in 2018 are permanent, the individual rates, I think it's either 2025 or 2026, we lose them. So I would caution individuals against doing this kind of planning without understanding that it's possible that in 6 or 7 years, that goes away. And now what? You know, now you've got this situation where it could be better, but it could be worse if you'd use these trust structures to try and get the benefit of a deduction. And then you lose that, things revert back to the way that they are currently, then you don't need that trust. I guess the answer would be you'd have to have a situation where you could get it out of the irrevocable nature of the trust. But all to say, there's a lot going on right now with people trying to structure around the tax issues. I believe that using these types of trusts continues to be important, mostly from an asset diversification standpoint. So I still advocate thinking about foreign jurisdictions as a place to custody assets, to think about diversifying out of the US dollar and think of things globally, only because it's become more and more clear that the world is shrinking, and it may very well be that the dollar is the best place to be, but who knows? I'm just an asset protection lawyer, and all I know is it's good to have buckets in a lot of different places.
What are some of the benefits of using offshore planning?
You know, the benefits could be, you know, using a foreign custodian. So there are some really good private banks in Europe that don't lend assets. If you start thinking about, gosh, you know, what will happen to my cash? What if we have a big bank crisis again? We know that, as Mrs. Clinton said in one of the debates, she said, if we've solved the bank issue, if you are in a systemically important bank, we've solved the issue. And she's right, we did solve it, but we solved it by protecting the bank and not the depositor, because the depositor will get an interest in the failed institution instead of cash back again. If you're a client holding a lot of cash, you have to understand what the risks are of your particular institution. You have to think about, gosh, is the FDIC really solvent? I'm not so sure I think that the FDIC is solvent any longer, which is why we need all of these new rules that Mrs. Clinton was referring to. So if I'm a big cash, if I have a lot of cash that's necessary for my business, et cetera, it might make sense to diversify that cash out of the U.S. banking system, not to take all of it out, but again, to put it in maybe one or two private banks so that if there is a problem in the U.S., you have cash offshore. If there's a problem in Europe or in Hong Kong or wherever, Singapore, wherever you are, then you've got your cash in the United States. Again, it's just a good diversification mechanism instead of thinking of the U.S. as having lots of types of bucket, which it does. Start thinking about it from a global standpoint. What if we had a failure? And again, it's the, you have to plan prospectively way before that problem occurs.
Yeah, and I think you make some really good points there. You've mentioned multiple buckets many times. Asset protection, like a good investment strategy, requires diversification. One of the trusts that I've begun to see a lot of clients do in recent years, especially those with, we'll call it dangerous hobbies, whether it be racing cars, flying, and owning an airplane, are these domestic asset protection trusts. What are your thoughts on those strategies?
So the domestic asset protection trusts, the problem with them for asset protection is kind of reverting back to the discussion we had a little bit earlier about what law will apply to those trusts. If the trustee, the protector, and the assets are located in that jurisdiction, then if a creditor gets a judgment against the individual, right, with the dangerous hobby, so the individual, I don't know, you know, is racing his racing bike and runs into the stands and injures somebody, right? And his insurance policy doesn't cover that liability, and there's a judgment against him eventually. The question is, what can that creditor reach? If he uses a domestic asset protection trust, the only way to have the laws of that jurisdiction apply to protect the assets from the claims of the creditor would be for the assets to be in that jurisdiction and all parties with control over the trust, not necessarily the investment advisor, but the custodian of the assets, the trustee and the protector, and the client can't have any control over the trust, can't have any demand rights, can't have the right to control investments, et cetera. Problem, Paul, really is that a lot of those structures are set up too loosely. And the case law that we've had so far, the courts have not held that the law of that jurisdiction applied, because in every case, assets or individuals were located outside of that jurisdiction.
Yeah, and I think you bring up a few excellent points there. One of them is when these trusts are being established, too many times I've heard horror stories where the I's aren't dotted, the T's aren't crossed. And so a good litigation lawyer will break through that trust and act as though the trust was never there.
That's right. That's right. Because there are all of these other arguments you can make to get to those trusts. Things like, well, the transfer was incomplete because the settlor retained so much power over the trust. Clients don't like to give up control, right? That is 100% of the discussion with clients. They want to believe that they can have asset protection and retain control, but they just can't. So all of those problem really is that the lawyers often, it's very hard to tell the client, sorry, this is the only way that you can make this work. You have to give up control. And so what we end up with is a situation where we have trusts where the settlor, who's located in California, actually controls the trust, has the ability to remove the trustee, those kinds of things. And then the court will say, you know what, with that much control, you never really transferred the assets. Therefore, I'm going to deem them as being actually held by you. Therefore, there is no trust. So that's another way you can get to that structure. And I agree with you. The majority of the trust structures, the domestic trust structures that I've seen or reviewed, there's so much control that it's really not worth it to pay money to have the structure in place.
Paying a whole lot of money for no benefit.
Right, exactly.
Elizabeth Morgan, it's been a pleasure having you on today. And I thank you very much for helping enlighten our listeners on understanding the importance and the need to have a good attorney in your court to really make sure that your strategies are set up. And not only are they set up, but they're set up correctly. Nothing worse than finding out after the fact that they weren't done correctly. If our clients want to reach out and speak with you about their individual situation, would they be able to do so?
They would. My website is still under construction. I took it down to redo it. But if anyone needs to reach me, they can absolutely reach me by emailing me at emorgan, so for Elizabeth, emorgan@emalegal.com. And if you just put my name in, Elizabeth Morgan, attorney, in Google, you can also find that information pretty easily.
Well, thank you for taking the time today, and happy 4th of July.
Thanks. You too, Paul. Bye-bye.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.